One of Cambridge University's great claims to fame is that there in the 1930s, five Englishmen were recruited to spy for the Soviet Union. Men who believed so deeply in the hopes of a better world, they were ready to betray their country for it. Their names: Anthony Blunt, Donald MacLean, John Cancross, Guy Burgess and Kim Philby. These men and their crimes have inspired films, television series, spy novels and dozens of history. So much has been said, but as time passes, more archives have been opened by Lithuania, Albania and Britain's security service, MI5. This is the material British journalist Antonia Senior has drawn on for her book Stalin's Apostles, The Cambridge Five and the Making of the Soviet Empire. Her aim, she says, is to count the cost of their treachery and debunk the rather glamorous myths that have grown up about the five. Antonia, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now, how come there is still material emerging about these men?
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, it's partly because the way that documents are released by the British security services is kind of very opaque. We can't really see what's going on. They just occasionally decide to dump reams of material, which then people like me kind of grab enthusiastically. So there was a massive tranche of files released in 2015, another load in 2022, and a massive dump of files just last year, all about the MI5 investigations into a couple of the members of the Cambridge Five. So that's partly it. And it's partly due to the opening, as you said in your wonderful introduction, the opening of the archives in the former parts of the communist world. So I used the Albanian archives, as you mentioned, to investigate some of Kim Philby's dealings with throwing partisans into Albania and into their kind of into the arms of the security services. And those Albanian secret police archives have only really been open for a couple of years. So it's incredibly exciting, really. There's loads of material and there's loads more still to come. There's loads more out there. There's unanswered questions, but there's huge amounts to work with as well.
Just in general terms, what did the latest document dumps tell you about the five? Did it change your view of them?
The most recent ones, the ones by MI5, which came out last year, were about the attempts to basically bring them to justice. And that did change my view, actually, because I'd long just accepted this rather cozy idea that it was a British establishment cover-up that meant that these guys were never really brought to justice. And then when you look at the files and you look at MI5's ongoing investigations into all of them, you can see that actually it's just incredibly difficult to prove espionage, and that they made mistakes, but they were trying over decades to pin these guys down. So that was one thing that really changed my mind. In terms of, you know, what they sent to the Soviets, etc., a lot of that stuff is still a little shrouded in mystery because MI6 files aren't open. The Russian files were open briefly, but obviously the current regime is less open than previous ones. So we can't get at those very handily. So what we're looking at really, I suppose, is kind of colour and detail rather than absolute bombshells in the most recent documents. But it doesn't mean that they're not, you know, adding greatly to the sum of our knowledge about these guys.
One of the things you convinced me of is the central role of Arnold Deutsch, an Austrian academic based in London. Tell us what Arnold Deutsch was about.
Oh, Deutsch is an incredible character. So he is, as you say, he's an Austrian. He comes to London. He's kind of married to two schools of kind of thought that were very in vogue in Austria in the 30s. The first is sort of Freudian psychology, and the second is Marxism. And he's committed to both of them, and he uses both of them in what he goes on to do for Soviet intelligence, who he is working for as what is called an illegal. This means he doesn't have diplomatic cover. He's sort of, you know, freelance, if you like, wandering around London trying to recruit people. So he does seem to have the idea. It does all seem to come from Arnold Deutsch. He looks around when he gets to England in the 1930s and sees that there's incredible kind of fashion amongst kind of well-to-do young people to be violent revolutionaries. And he thinks, this is brilliant. I'm going to tap into this. So he thinks, if I can get a few recruits while they're very young, sign them up now and then sort of watch them rise up through the ranks of the British establishment and get jobs in the Foreign Office and elsewhere, then, you know, I can have this sort of future trail of wonderful secrets coming my way. So that's how he set out, really. And it was a brilliant wheeze. It worked fantastically, probably beyond his wildest dreams. And he was the man who started the whole process of recruiting the Cambridge Five. And the first one of them that he met was Kim Philby, which was a kind of meeting through Austrian communist circles, because Kim Philby had been in Austria and married a Austrian communist. So that's how it all starts.
And what's recruited is a wonderful term we discover in the book, chapocracy.
Yes. So this is what I use to describe what happens, which is that so these young men that end up being recruited through Arnold Deutsch and Kim Philby, they initially don't have huge amounts of purchase in the British state, apart from Donald MacLean and John Cancross, who go straight into the Foreign Office. But then when the war breaks out, there's this incredible thirst to find clever men to join the secret bits of the British state, right? So MI6 increases tenfold, MI5 tenfold, etc. And the way they recruit is by a method which I call the chapocracy. And they don't see this as being, you know, in any way a bad thing. It's a deliberate policy. Do you know this chap? Has your wife met this chap? Could you take this chap for a drink in your club? That's the kind of criteria they're using to recruit people, because they're doing it incredibly fast and incredibly, I guess, sloppily. So they think that the best sort of bulwark against, unknown evil entities entering these secret parts of states is the chapocracy. You know, is this guy a decent chap? Yep, bring him in, give him a gin.
Exactly. I love the portrait of Cancross. What a dud.
Cancross is actually hilarious. I feel like there's much more to be written about Cancross, because he's both kind of incredibly elusive, incredibly ridiculous, and also at times you think, hang on, maybe he's actually incredibly sinister. So the other four are kind of charming and well-connected and handsome and whatever, and incredibly successful with either ladies or men, whichever their inclinations go. John Cancross is sort of very short. When he gets his job at the Foreign Office, he has to get a special cushion to sit on because his little feet don't touch the floor. And he's sort of quite spiky. He's not as upper class as the others. He comes from a sort of lower class Scottish background. When you see him meeting the others, because he's not really within the ring, it's a slight misunderstanding that this is a closed circle. He's a kind of outlier. And, you know, occasionally he'll turn up at one of their fabulous, glamorous parties and pester the women. You know, this is how John Cancross's kind of social connection to them. But he does actually give incredible secrets to the Russians. He's the first person who tells them, for example, that the British have had this brilliant idea that it might be possible to create a nuclear weapon. John Cancross is the first atomic spy. Then he gets a job at Bletchley Park, where we're decoding the German secret codes, the Enigma machines. And that's an incredible bit of the story. He's just working as an interpreter in one of these huts, and at the end of the day, these incredibly priceless German decrypts are littering the floor of the hut, and John Cancross just stoops down, picks them up, stuffs them down his trousers, and walks out of the door to meet his handler. You know, that's the kind of level we're talking about.
But they were all walking out the door with their briefcases full of documents, photographs, secrets. Nobody searched to see what they were taking out. They'd take them home, copy them, and bring them back to work the next day, because they were chaps.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, they were chaps.
It was partly because they were chaps, you know, so even the Soviets were astonished by how many documents they just walked out of the office with. And, you know, there's brilliant details like Guy Burgess is always meeting his Soviet handler in the pub when he's drunk. And at one point he drops a whole sheaf of top secret documents on the floor of the, you know, men's bathroom in the pubs, and they have to kind of peel them off the floor. It's absolutely incredible how much information they can bring out. But part of it is just a failure of imagination. It does not occur to the British that at this time of extraordinary existential peril, when they are fighting against the Nazis for the survival of Britain and its wider empire and Commonwealth, it does not occur to them that men who they kind of believe to be on the inside could be secretly betraying them to the Soviets. It's only the kind of, you know, busting of the Cambridge Five spy ring that makes it a kind of possible thing to imagine that they could exist. So that's, I think, why there was so much laxity around the documents. It just never occurred to people.
And of course, finally, to prove what a cad Cairn Cross was, he was actually being paid. The others weren't, but he was being paid.
Yeah, so this is one of the things that emerged from those documents I told you that had been released last year. MI5 do a kind of almost like a cold case review into John Cairn Cross in the 80s, and they do discover that he is the one who does seem to have been quite happy to pocket money from the Soviet. So, you know, they get him a car and a flat, and they pay for membership of these various clubs that he has to belong to be kind of a pucker British gentleman, and they do seem to have given him cash, whereas the others at various points refuse to take too much off the Soviet. It's partly to protect themselves because, you know, it's easier to remain under the radar if you don't accept anything. But it's also because they were doing it out of conviction. With Cairn Cross, yeah, he was on the take. I think there's much more to be written about Cairn Cross, actually. Very interesting chap.
Do you think that the attitude of the authorities would have been different if these five men were spying for the enemy instead of spying for an ally?
I think it might have been slightly different in the sense that during the war and afterwards, the five were always able to kind of use this slight wrinkle in terms of motivation to kind of justify their actions. Okay, so they can say, but Stalin's an ally, you know, we didn't do anything particularly wrong. But, you know, that completely ignores the fact that from 1939 to 1941, when they were enthusiastically supplying information to Stalin, he was effectively allied to Hitler. It also doesn't cover the fact that, you know, from mid-44 onwards, we realise we've got a Stalin problem. And, you know, from then onwards, he's very much, you know, they are supplying secrets to someone who we think we are going to be fighting a war with imminently. I mean, we know now it's a Cold War. In the years that Cambridge Five were active, 45 to 51, it was pretty much given that that Cold War would at some point turn hot, and they were spying for Stalin. So I'm not sure the fact that he was our ally massively stopped them being brought to book. I think more it's back to this point that proving spying is incredibly difficult. So they didn't imagine they existed. When they discover that they existed, they then find it incredibly difficult to pin them down, and they make horrible mistakes, and, you know, there's a lot of I don't know, can I use the word arse covering on
yes, you can.
Yeah, good. Well, there's an awful lot of kind of, rather than sort of, you know, thinking about it as a sort of the establishment as a kind of blob that acts as a kind of autonomous thing, think about it as individuals within these institutions realizing, oh my God, what have I told these guys? I knew this guy. I went to lunch with him all the time, you know. So there's lots of individual arse covering that adds up to what looks like a kind of institutional failure.
But now, look, let's go back to the wartime and pursue what you're very intent on doing in the book, which is to show the human cost of this spying. And where do you think the greatest cost lay?
Yeah, you're right. This was my intent in the book. I had this very strong sense that we had begun to think of this as a victimless crime, or if there were victims, it was just the establishment, which we don't kind of hold much of a torch for anymore anyway. And I wanted to turn the book around and think, what did Stalin want from these men? What was Stalin's foreign policy goals that these men were helping him fulfill? And if you look at what Stalin was up to over the period that these guys were spying from him, which is broadly 1934 to 1951, what he wants is the expansion of the Soviet world out beyond Russia's borders and into Europe. He's an internationalist. He's a communist internationalist who believes in kind of revolution by force. And they're incredibly helpful in that role. So I think if you kind of look back and kind of look at the totality of what they were giving Stalin and what he seemed to be interested in and what he was using it for, what he was using it for was to cement his control over Eastern and Central Europe. Now, obviously, the single most important fact is Red Army boots on the ground at the end of the war. You can't get past that. But he had to turn his military advantage into political control. And I think they were incredibly helpful fit to him in that endeavour. So, you know, if you want to be blunt, the victims were the men and women of Eastern Europe who found themselves under Stalin's yoke, despite, you know, not wanting to be there at all. They didn't want utopia. It came for them.
And the men who were parachuted into those countries to try to stop Stalin were all betrayed to Stalin.
Yeah. So this is the kind of most sort of brutal bit of the story, I guess. So from mid-1944, when they realize they've got a Soviet problem, they decide to set up a kind of anti-Soviet counterintelligence unit within MI6 operating throughout Europe. And the man they put in charge of that is top Soviet spy Kim Philby. So from 1944 to 1951, when he kind of effectively stops being useful to the Russians, almost every kind of attempt to parachute displaced persons across the Iron Curtain into, you know, Poland, into the Baltic states, into Ukraine, Philby's betraying it all. And he then goes to Washington as the liaison with the CIA's operations behind the Iron Curtain. So from sort of that period, from like 1949 onwards, Philby is also betraying all the American operations into Eastern Europe and Central Europe and into the kind of fringes of the Soviet Union. And, you know, sometimes he does it personally. You know, he's stationed in Turkey for a while. He literally takes young men to the border with the Soviet Union, pushes them across the border and hears the gunfire.
And he scuttled Western attempts to overthrow the Albanian dictator Enver Hoxha.
Yeah, so there's a concerted effort, which is a kind of joint effort between the British and the Americans to send men into Albania. They rather derisively refer to these brave young Albanians they send across the border. They call them pixies. And this is a kind of joint enterprise, which does initially start out with this idea that it might include regime change, although they quickly kind of row that back when they realize how difficult it's going to be. But they are kind of, it's almost like a kind of SOE type operation, special operations executive during the war. You know, it's this idea that you send people in, they make some mischief, they bring out some intelligence, they cause problems, they give a kind of totemic quality to resistance. But all these men that were being sent in, Philby was literally the man in charge of liaising with the Americans over these operations. So they're all being, they're being held in almost like prison camp conditions and then sent into Albania. And the Albanian secret police know that they are coming. And it is a pretty horrific operation. And what's worse is it just keeps on going, because once Philby's been busted, and they kind of, from 51 onwards, they kind of know that he's a spy and he gets put out into the cold. These operations are already so compromised that they are, you know, deeply kind of transparent to the both the Albanian secret police and the wider Soviet secret police in the other areas. But the British and the Americans think, aha, the reason this stuff was failing was because of Philby. Now Philby's gone, everything's going to be fine. So they keep sending people and people keep dying.
And on the home front, you discover that a couple of the five are wife bashers.
Yeah, so this was really interesting to me. And I wondered afterwards whether it was just because, you know, I'm a woman writing about this, I'd noticed this. So we'd known like that Donald MacLean was pretty horrible to his wife. But the extent of it, I was shocked to discover, and I didn't think it had been significantly sort of played in the existing material. He strangled her in front of people, you know, in front of his colleagues on a boat going down the Nile. He hit her in front of one of his friends. You know, he was about 6'4", Donald MacLean. He's a really big guy. His wife was very, very petite. And if he's doing that to her in public, what is he doing to her in private? Absolutely horrific. And then Kim Philby, his second wife is Eileen. And Philby's actually always got quite a free ride about what happens to Eileen, because she was clearly mentally disturbed. You know, there are various things going on in her life which make it obvious that she's not a well woman. But if you're married to a kind of narcissist lunatic like Philby, I mean, I'm not sure I would be a well woman. But anyway, Eileen eventually commits suicide. And in these most recent documents I found, there was a letter from her psychiatrist to her GP. And that psychiatrist knew all the secrets of the Philby marriage. And as soon as he heard that she'd committed suicide, he got in touch with her GP and demanded that the doctor check her body for puncture wounds. He was like, Philby has murdered her, or he has had her murdered. I am completely implacably convinced of that. Horrible. And that's MI5 later put this to Anthony Blunt. They say, do you think Philby murdered Eileen? And Blunt said, look, I don't know, but he was definitely ruthless enough. He was capable of it.
The West lives with the embarrassment of the Cambridge Five. But what does Russia think of them these days?
This is such a fascinating part of the story. So for a long time, they were a bit of an embarrassment in the Soviet Union as well. They kind of turn up there in exile thinking they're going to be heroes, and they're sort of left to fester and become drunk and sleep with each other's wives. You know, it's all unedifying. But recently, Vladimir Putin, as part of his sort of myth-making about himself as a kind of anti-Nazi crusader, has rediscovered the story of the Cambridge Five, and he's kind of, you know, co-opting them into that vision, into that myth. So there's a new square being named after Philby in Russia, just outside in Moscow, just outside the headquarters of the Foreign Intelligence Service. He's put up a statue to Philby.
A statue?
Yeah, there's a statue to Philby.
Wow.
Just near the battlefield at Kursk, which was the kind of turning point bit of the war. The irony being that although Philby did supply information to the Russians that might have helped him at Kursk, it was at a period where actually they didn't trust him very much, so they probably didn't use it anyway. But anyway, there he is, standing, immortalized forever, on the battlefield at Kursk, which is a kind of sacral place to the Russians because of this kind of the way that their victory in the Great Patriotic War, as they call it, has kind of fed into the national myth-making. And yeah, and there's like various other things I could name, but basically the Cambridge Five, particularly Kim Philby, are being sort of used as part of this kind of writing of the Putin-era story of Russian anti-Nazism.
Do you think Philby was allowed to slip away to Moscow?
So there were various details in the documents that came out last year. I am normally, when confronted with a kind of situation where it's either cock-up or conspiracy, I always think it's a cock-up. In this case, I'm not so sure because of these details that came out last year. So this friend of Kim Philby's, Nicholas Elliott, goes out to Beirut to confront him with some new information. Philby's working there as a freelance journalist. And Elliott does confront him, but then nothing seems to happen. Then Elliott leaves him there. MI5 get very excited. And they're sending all these messages asking for questions to be put to Philby. And there's no kind of trace of those questions ever actually being put to Philby. And then, crucially, there is a document in the new tranche of documents that came out last year, which showed that the British went to the Americans and said, listen, Philby's confessed, but this is a very delicate situation. Tell your men in Beirut not to watch him or go anywhere near him because we're debriefing him and we don't want him to get spooked. Now, you could take that on face value. You could also take it on the British trying to get rid of the Americans so that they can, let Philby slip away, because they have the same problem they had with the others, that they cannot prove espionage. And the only way they got Philby to confess was by offering him immunity from prosecution. So then you have this awful situation, which you simultaneously have at the same time with Blunt, that you know he's a spy, he's confessed to being a spy, but you can't prosecute him. So all the press and anybody on the outside just thinks you're incompetent and useless. So in one sense, you can see why the motive is there to let him slip away.
And meanwhile, meanwhile, the Queen knows that the man who looks after her pictures, her not inconsiderable collection of pictures, Sir Anthony Blunt, was also a spy in the Second World War, and she deals with him for, what, 20 years or something, knowing that he's a spy and he keeps his job.
Yeah, I know, it's extraordinary. So in 1963, Anthony Blunt confesses in return for this offer of immunity, right? So you've got this situation where everybody in the know knows, right?
Including Her Majesty.
Although it does look like the Queen wasn't told then. Okay, so the Queen's told later.
Right.
But her private secretary knows, and even after she does know, she's still quite nice to him. So it's a really bizarre situation because, you know, if you've accepted this confession on the basis of immunity, what do you do? Do you strip him of everything and publicly humiliate him and shame him?
Well, that'd be a start, wouldn't it?
Well, it would, but that's not the basis on which he confessed. So the basis on which Anthony Blunt confessed was, you get secrecy and immunity, and you just tell us what happened. Because, crucially, MI5 at this period are absolutely convinced, or at least some of them in MI5, are absolutely convinced that there is another caught unrecognized mole at the heart of MI5 and they want to find him. And they think that Anthony Blunt is a really good way of potentially finding that guy. And they actually, you know, there are other lower level spies that they take Anthony Blunt into interviews to try and get him to help them crack. You know, they're bugging him, they're watching him. They interview him more than 80 times. It's not like they leave him alone, but you can see the logic of why they did it.
Was he useful?
So no, he wasn't hugely useful, to be honest.
Antonia, but a last question. Did anybody in MI5 or MI6 lose their job for the failure to expose this spy ring?
Not really, no. And the one thing I did find, which kind of amused me, but also was quite appalling, was, you know, so Donna McLean was at the Foreign Office, and Donna McLean, I think, is incredibly consequential, and he gives unbelievable secrets to the Soviets. And then when it all comes out, you know, the Foreign Office did what the Foreign Office does. It doesn't sack anybody. It just, the ones who are a bit too implicated, it sends on postings it thinks are a bit unpucker, right? So they end up in sort of obscure bits of the empire or something, and they don't get the job in Paris that they've been angling for. That's how people get punished.
Oh, God.
Terrible.
Antonia, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
I've been talking to Antonia Senior, author, journalist, and the author of a new book on the Five, Stalin's Apostles, The Cambridge Five, and The Making of the Soviet Empire.